So this bolt of lightning shot across the universe and inspired me with the idea that we have to do a podcast. And that's what I wanted to tell you. We should do a podcast. Okay, bye.
We've ruined it. That's okay. We'll use it anyway. We have very little time. Quick, go. Okay. Welcome to Feature Creep, colon.
Built-in microwave, semicolon.
Oh, shit. The title of the... Oh, a miasma of missing mission must-haves.
Yeah.
Okay, so first of all, welcome to our podcast. I'm Ned. This is Meg.
Yo.
You can email us. You can email Dana. She's the CEO and... founder of this podcast, so you can email Dana, D-A-N-A, at fcbm.io. She'll forward it to us if it's relevant or, you know, whatever. Or you can go to our website and get our email addresses directly, fcbm.io. We've given up on social media. That's your option.
Right.
or you may know us in person and you'll just text us directly.
You'll just tell us. From time to time.
And it's funny, too, because I get a lot of, there's definitely... a small following of people that I consider friends that I hang out with who often are like when we were down for like over a month, they were like, what the fuck? Where's all the new episodes?
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, there's a huge back catalog. And one of them was like, looked at me sheepishly. Like, I've already listened to all of those.
Oh my God.
Which is great and amazing.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that it brought them so much joy. Anyway, so how the hell did we get to this particular topic?
Right.
And what is a miasma of missing mission must-haves, comma, and other catastrophes, as you put? So if you're not aware, how Meg and I often come up with our podcast topics, et cetera, is we have sort of a running stream of consciousness text chain between us. And
right.
We tag any potential topics as we think of them. And so this particular one was tagged by Meg after what I'm now going to describe to you, Meg, was a little bit of our chat. So we were talking about Ocean Gate, which is an episode.
Oh, yes.
So that turned into an episode, and that was published on July 7th, 2023. So if you are also interested in listening to that, you don't need to have listened to that one to understand this one, but just be aware that was something we were talking about. And so we were kind of, you know, like sort of gallows humor back and forth a little bit. Like, it's a little bit private. It's not something that we would like represent as like, I think everybody should die in a submarine. Like, it's definitely not, you know, death is death and it's tragic. But we were sort of joking between each other about like, I think at one point, so in the chat, we joined ourselves in the chat on July 20th. And I said, and the joystick failed too? Oh, wait, it did. So we were kind of joking about like what could possibly go wrong in this like essentially, you know, homemade unprofessional sub. I mean,
right.
Sorry, multi-million dollar company. And so, and then you made the comment so stupid. And I was like, yeah, a celebration of stupidity. And then we're starting the repertoire that makes us laugh a lot.
Right. Clever rephrasing of current events.
So then Meg goes, an orgy, if you will, on account of the accompanying conspicuous consumption. And then a veritable smorgasbord of design fails, an impossibility of hubris.
Yes. A miasma of missing mission must-haves.
Yeah, a glorious glutton of ego. A miasma of missing must-haves, which is which is where we arrived at this. So here we are. And if you're not familiar with Ocean Gate, the Titan submersible implosion, great. Just a really quick sub like recap. If you just have no idea, there was this company called Ocean Gate. Founded by this person, Stockton Rush. And
we knew that they were bound to be a failure because they self-applied the term gate.
To their,
ocean. And, like, anyone living in America who's alive now should be within recent enough memory of Watergate to recognize that anything with gate on it just becomes a scandal or is an indicator of a scandal after the fact. So I don't know why you'd self-apply the term gate, but whatever. So, OceanGate gate.
Yeah. So this company created this submersible called Titan that had been... They were basically selling sort of commercial trips down to see the Titanic wreckage, and in a freak tragedy that no one could have predicted, on the 18th of June 2023, the Titan submersible imploded on the seafloor after some technical failures, which led to the discussion of like missing mission must-haves, right?
Right.
And a lot of things came to light after that accident. That is a tragedy for the people who died.
And like the things that came to light afterward were such that like they were such details that any reasonable person learning about this would have been right to assume that it would only end in tragedy.
Right.
Like, and there was no way it could succeed.
Yeah. And there was a lot of like, you know, I think our biggest takeaway from this whole situation was kind of the tragedy for us was obviously there was what's his name's son who ended up on the trip, and
there was one innocent person on the trip, and he was a kid who like got like slotted in to go with his dad after his mother, or I believe it was his mother at the last minute was like, oh, I can't go, you go. And so she like basically forked her kid over into a death trap to avoid going herself, and then his aunt was upset about it.
And so the biggest sign of takeaway I think for us after a lot of discussion was that the problem of like informed consent was not possible.
Not
provided in a way that was meaningful. It's really hard for someone who has no real experience with like underwater diving to really appreciate the amount of pressure that a vessel like that
well,
is
well also be if it's your dad and your mom telling you you have to go, like that's coercive.
Also all of these things, but my point being is like, so how did we arrive, you know, what the fuck does it mean to have a miasma of missing mission must-haves?
I
feel like we should just sort of break this down. Like, what does one mean when they say miasma? And it usually means a highly unpleasant or unhealthy smell or vapor, an oppressive or unpleasant atmosphere which surrounds or emanates.
Exactly. The atmosphere. There's a general cloud of terrible surrounding this entire fucking project.
Right. Yeah. And so these missing mission must-haves are things that really kind of came out of a lot of the discussion once this thing had become much more public. And then it turned out there were a lot of very experienced advisors who had either, you know, suggested directly to Stockton or somehow to the company that like this was a really bad design. Like this was not this was not going to work for what they were trying to do. And in many ways, it's kind of a miracle that it made the successful trips that it did before.
Oh my God.
Died. Like,
it's just crazy that it made it as far as it did.
Yeah.
Like, the way that they constructed it, it basically virtually ensured from an engineering perspective its failure.
Yeah.
Because it couldn't withstand, like, there's all of these compressive forces and pressure pressing in on the vessel when you submerge it. And the further down you go, the more pressure there is because they've got the weight of all of that water on top of you pressing in from every angle.
Yeah.
And they didn't build it in a way that the structure itself of the submersible could withstand those forces. And like, this is not like, they liked to kind of like paint it as this sort of like cutting edge, nobody's ever done something like this before. Like, nobody can know, so we're just figuring it out as we go. And it's like, all of that is untrue. Like, and hilariously, I think we talked about this in the Ocean Gate episode. Like, Damon and I had a much better impression of James Cameron, the like filmmaker who made Titanic, who like up to this point I sort of like disregarded as an obsessive about the Titanic itself, and also like kind of an obnoxious guy because he makes these crazy overblown movies and stuff, and Avatar was fucking terrible. Anyway,
you should see the second one. You think the first one was bad. Anyway, sorry, go on.
God, what is worse, going on a Titan subride or sitting through Avatar 2? So the like whole thing with James Cameron is that he's actually really knowledgeable about like submersibles, deep sea submersibles, and he's been down in the Mariana Trench like really deep, and so he like all of these people who do this weird extreme diving shit know each other, and so they were kind of like, hey, this whole Titan sub seems like a really bad idea for these very clear, demonstrable, right, like provable reasons that are like built into how engineering is done. Like nobody is unclear or questioning any of this. It's all like math and stuff. So they tried to warn Stockton Rush a bazillion times, but his deal wasn't actually like that he was doing any of this for magnanimous reasons or to further people's understanding of deep sea exploration or like any of that stuff. His whole deal is he just wanted to get rich off of it, which is why it was such a hack job and why like nobody reputable would have anything to do with it. And a bunch of people tried to stop him because they were like, you're just going to kill unwitting people who are dumb enough to believe or uneducated enough to believe that you actually know what you're talking about. And like when we first heard about the Titan submersible thing, it was when they were still on television at the very outset of it, pretending like they could still be alive down there somewhere,
right,
which they proceeded to do for like three or four fucking torturously long days when like everybody else who has any inkling of the science and the like forces involved are like, those people are dead already. Like, why are you pretending they're alive and like banging on the inside of a sub on the ocean floor somewhere? So like, obviously not. And so anyway, once like the whole like thing starts to come out, and they're doing all of this like retrospective coverage, like, so what, who are these people trapped at the bottom of the ocean and what are they doing down there? And so they like would roll all of this like film that they had from back in the day when Good Morning America or whoever did some documentary thing about this Titan sub. Well, anyway, the guy who made it, like, it, once I first saw photos of the submersible itself and the inside of it, I was like, oh my God.
Right. Yeah.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
This looks like the bottom tier, like if you went to an Enterprise car rental and you rented a bottom tier minivan. That's what the inside of this fucking submersible looks like.
Oh, no, worse than that. It was like, it looked like a bachelor pad that somebody had moved into and was just like, there's a deck chair, I guess, if someone needs to sit down. And then otherwise, you guys can sit on the floor, right? That's fine.
Yeah. Everybody's sitting on the floor in their socking feet.
Yeah.
And like, they're using like a fucking PlayStation off-brand remote control to pilot the thing around. Anyway, it was a huge joke. I mean, like, it wasn't even, they didn't even put any energy into making it look like it could survive trip to like, the bottom of the ocean and back again.
The camping space in the back of my truck, like,
yes!
With a camper cap, like, it's not even a camper cap, it's just like, yes, a shell. Like, I throw, you know, when I go camping, it's like I literally just throw like a futon mattress in the back of there and call it good. And that's literally like what this looks like. It's like there's a couple of screens leaning against a wall, there's some place to sit. Like, it's just
it's like a giant toilet paper tube with a piece of plywood wedged on the bottom to sit on, so that you have a flat surface instead of the bottom of the tube.
Exactly.
And like, and it kind of sort of looks like the inside of an elevator.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yep.
I mean, like, you would think, oh my gosh, submersible that goes down 3,000 meters or whatever, right? Like, there's got to be all kinds of modes of feedback, right? So like monitors, screens, computers telling you things, buttons to push, stuff that lights up, stuff that doesn't light up, like like anything to tell you anything about what's going on. None of that stuff exists. It doesn't exist. It's not part of the experience at all.
I also think that anytime we kind of mention Ocean Gate, we should talk about the actual disaster that happened at the same time, which was the 2023 Messenia migrant boat disaster. We don't have to talk much about it other than just to like, because the biggest thing about the whole issue was like the Titan submersible thing was like blowing up on everywhere, and it was like, meanwhile, I think it was 82 people were drowning to death like in the ocean on this migrant
boat. In an actual tragedy.
Like an actual, right. Like, you know, lots of lives are lost. I mean, not that, you know, every life is a perfect little snowflake, but you got
no, but one is a tragedy and one isn't. Because right. one of them, the 82 people who drowned trying to flee to freedom.
Yes.
And it's like those people were facing sudden death and like irrefutable demise if they didn't take their chances on a fucking overloaded boat crossing the Mediterranean, right?
Yeah.
So, like, that's a fucking tragedy because those people were trying to save their own lives in a really desperate situation, and they picked the least bad option and died anyway. The people on the Titan sub were... One was coerced.
Yeah.
Another one was going to further his own career at the expense of other people.
Yep.
Another one was a billionaire who felt like he could just buy his way into fancy adventures that other people have to, like, technically train for their entire lives to be proficient enough to survive these adventures. He's like, I'll just pay for somebody else to take the risk. And then, like, the person who built the fucking Titan sub, who, despite repeated recommendations and warnings from actual experts in the field, was like, nope, I'm totally copacetic doing this the wrong way and taking a bunch of people out with me.
Yes,
so that's not a fucking tragedy. Right. That's a bunch of negligence and coercion rolled into one, like, foreseeable accident. It's not even an accident because it was foreseeable. Yep. A foreseeable, like, catastrophe.
Yeah, just...
So, like they were talking about the Titan sub, like, it was some, like, oh my God, isn't this terrible? How could this happen? We've got to rescue those poor people. Those were not poor people. They were not poor people by any measure of money or power. Like,
right.
No, they engineered a situation to be unsafe, and then they demanded a huge amount of time and effort and risking of other people's lives in a futile attempt to locate them.
Yeah.
Using the Coast Guard in international waters. And when they purposefully skirted all of the rules that those agencies abide by in order to build and operate safe craft. So, like, they did everything wrong on purpose. And then they relied on other people doing everything right to save them, which didn't happen in the end because they fucked up so badly. They were unsavable. But, like, all of that was getting all of this press while, like, people who actually had real problems.
Yeah.
That were not self-generated, were, like, dying from a lack of assistance in the middle of the fucking Mediterranean Ocean. And that got almost no coverage whatsoever.
Yeah, it's nuts. It was, you know, one of the biggest things that was just, like, immediately evident was that the way that was set up, they were carrying passengers that did not board the vessel from any known port. And so it was not subject to any kind of, like, regulatory agency or there was no... agency that deemed the vessel seaworthy, and so they were completely like skirting all of these sort of safety regulations,
right?
That, almost
because
every
they knew
enforces,
they knew better,
they knew it would never pass, and so they're just like, it's fine, we know what we're doing. What could possibly go wrong? Turns out,
right? Turns out
there's a miasma of missing mission. Missing mission. What was the title?
A miasma of missing mission must-haves.
Yeah, missing mission must-haves. Yeah, like redundant safety features, like a pressure-tested vessel that is certified to withstand the pressures at that depth and also do repeated trips, etc. Like all of these things that were just like not really happening.
They didn't do any of the normal testing that you would subject a vessel to before trying to take it to the bottom of the ocean because they knew it wouldn't pass the testing. And then they're like, well, then we wouldn't have a vessel to take out to the ocean.
You know, this reminds me, this reminds me of, you know, speaking of like the miasma of missing mission must-haves, I think of like other endeavors like this where, so I think of like Apollo 13, right? I only have the movie plus like a little bit of Wikipedia reading to know about it. Like I'm sure I'm missing like some key factors or like some more depth to it. But even if you've just watched the movie or you're like passingly familiar with the story, it's like this was a perfect example where having mission must-haves made the difference between people surviving and people dying.
Like, yes.
This was a situation where all of these things went wrong, but they had all of these. And even when the they had fail safes and they had, backups and alternate options, and they exhausted so many of them, were unable to complete the mission, and yet, like, these people returned home alive. And then you, like, you look at, like, my understanding is, like, the failure with the Ocean Gate Titan submersible, if I remember correctly, like, at some point there's, like, the audio that comes back, and they're talking about, like, these failures that start to happen, and speculation about how the implosion happened. And like, all of it is, like one thing goes wrong, and then it's just, like, it's just a cascade of failures with no way to correct it. There was, like, some speculation that the ballast didn't work correctly, which is, like, how they control their buoyancy.
Oh, not only did it not work correctly, there was nothing standardized about the ballast. It was all scavenged construction material detritus.
Right.
So, like, let's just take this broken chunk of cement and these, like, discarded pipes from this construction site and shove them into the bottom of this, like, thing. And then as we, like, tumble down through the column of water, it'll shift around a bunch and we have no control over it. Like, it's not like we loaded up 16 of these identically formed weights so that each one was identical. And if you needed to, you could drop them one by one in a controlled manner to, like, raise the vessel to safety if it was experiencing distress
or attitude and
or leveling or anything like that. No, it was just literally a bunch of junk they shoved in the bottom.
Yeah.
And, like, we're like, whatever, it weighs something, it's fine.
Yeah, like, we'll just open the door and hopefully it'll fall off.
Like, you work in computers, and I've spent a lot of time around you and Damon, who works in computers, and so, like, I know what a failsafe is, but I just want to mention it in case anyone listening doesn't understand what that is, because, like, it's such a jargony term, even though it kind of, like, it seems obvious when you say it out loud. A failsafe is something that, like, you design systems, whether it's a system of components that fit together to make a submersible in the ocean, or, like, a computer system that's networked or whatever. You design it such that you know ahead of time if one part of it doesn't work, the whole thing doesn't implode.
Right. Like the idea
you limit how much damage occurs if something fails to work the way it's supposed to.
Yeah,
and it stays a contained problem.
Yeah, like, you try to design something so that as it fails in a safe way. Like, for instance, like, a door. So if you had a door to, like, a sealed room, right, where if the door if the door is sealed, like, there's a limited amount of oxygen in the room, and so one doesn't want to spend that much time in the room. And so the fail-safe mechanism on the latch would be such that if the latch fails, it won't fail in a locked position. Like, like, there might be a spring that keeps the bolt into the retainer, but then if the you know, if the spring fails, then there's, like, you know, a secondary spring that pushes the bolt back or something. Like, something, you know, and it's even fail-safe sometimes fail, but the idea is, like, you work through these iterations of testing and you look at all of the fail points before you, like, subject people to these, like, very dangerous conditions. And then you try to have these, like, graceful failures. Code, software code like that is, I try to write it that way. There's not, unfortunately, like, we call software engineering engineering, but it's, there's not a lot of engineering going on. It's mostly just, like, you know, it's more, it's definitely, I would say, more in the realm of, like the contractor sort of housing development space, where it's like you have some good contractors who follow, like, a lot of the regulation, but the regulations are there to enforce that they do that, right? And you might have good contractors with no regulation who'd be like, well, I want things to be safe, but software development's kind of the same way. Like, we don't, there needs to be, like, some kind of external agency that's, like, enforcing, like, good structure, right? But there's not.
And but so, there's not,
you know, I think in some industries, like, probably car and aerospace, where where there's software that's being imposed, like, there's more regulation. But as we've seen, there was I can't remember what that was. It like a 737 or something. There was that weird automated system that
ended up the 737 MAX, and they're still having problems with them.
Right.
And I just read a story. Interesting that you mentioned this, because I was thinking about this while you were talking about it, and I was going to bring it up if you hadn't mentioned it. But I was just reading a story, and it was something in my email. So now I didn't think to save it to have this conversation that we're having right now. But it was within the last two or three days. I read about a former I believe, executive who worked for Boeing, who left, who resigned and retired because he was like, I can't fucking do this anymore. Mm-hmm. I think it was 2018. He told, he tried to like raise the alarm bells about how Boeing was working and how a lot of their, oversight and their, processes to ensure, safety were like their safety culture was completely blown apart. It just didn't exist anymore. And so the way that they were doing things ensures that with enough repetition, something's going to go wrong because you're failing to meet the benchmarks for safety. So if you're flipping a coin 100 times, it's going to land on heads 50 and land on tails 50, right? Like that's the idea. And it's the same sort of thing with safety culture. Like if it's absent and you're cranking out part after part after part after part on this like assembly line of building planes, and your main goal is getting the planes out the door, not making sure that each part works before you pass it on to the next stage of like construction or development or whatever, what you're doing is you're building failure into the system. And so this guy who used to work for Boeing was like, I resigned, and then right after that was the first 737 MAX crash that killed a bunch of people, and then there was another one, and then there's the thing with the air blowing, the like port blowing off of the side of the aircraft in Alaska, and like all of these things, and he's like, it's just going to keep happening because people who are currently working for Boeing say that the conditions at the places where they build these airplanes are worse now than they were, than the conditions were that led to the crashes over the last 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So like, yeah, it's, there's just, don't fly on a seven, don't fly Boeing. If you get to the fucking airport and it's on a Boeing aircraft, don't take the flight. Like that's away. What it's at. That's where we are at now. It's crazy. This is how, you know, over enough time, this is like the coyote running off the cliff in the cartoon and not realizing there's nothing under him until it's too late. We're at that spot now. We're the coyote realizing, oh shit, there's nothing under us anymore.
Uh-huh.
And it's true for airplanes. It's true for our politics.
Right.
It's true for, like, there's a bunch of our healthcare system. It's all going. So, miasma of missing mission must-haves in a bunch of different places right now in, like, our cultural establishments, and institutions. But yeah, so the Boeing thing, totally fucking crazy. Same deal, right? Just like,
yep.
It's like it's the difference between like we've done everything we could and we hope to succeed, or we've done nothing and so we can't expect anything but failure.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Like that's the difference. You can't necessarily guarantee 100% success all of the time, but you can definitely take steps to mitigate failure. And accordingly, you can not take any of those steps to mitigate failure and know with 100% certainty that you will fail because you didn't do anything to ensure your success.
Right?
Yeah, it's kind of like...
I mean, yeah.
It's all about what you can know, right? You can't know that you'll succeed, but you can definitely know that you will fail.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. And so you can plan for that.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, the missing mission must-haves. I mean, oh my God. Like, I just thought, so our whole lives ground to a halt when the fucking Titan sub thing happened last summer.
Yeah.
Because also that was not like, what are some other things? Like when Russia invaded Ukraine 2 years ago, we got hijacked by that too. Like whatever we were doing, we're like, stop everything. Fucking here comes World War III. And, the Titan sub was kind of similar because we were like, wait, what's going on? And I thought, oh my God, this is crazy. Like I assumed, like everybody else, that some well-intentioned and competent people had suffered a tragedy doing something that is inherently high risk, right?
Right.
And then the more we looked into it, the more I'm like, oh my God, these people are morons. These people are dangerous idiots.
Yes.
And then we just started digging in. So like, there's a bunch of YouTube channels that we watch of like engineers. So we flipped over to the engineers and the aerospace people, and they were like, oh my God. And so we were like listening to them. And then there were also people who were talking about like, after a couple of days of more and more details trickling out about this situation, I was like, oh my God, the nonprofit manager in me is like, I want to see some financials from this company.
Yes, right.
Right? Well, the financials were fucked. Yeah, just they were royally bizarre. Fucked. They yeah. had no money. The guy who built the submarine was like the one putting up all the money. He basically was like telling everybody, oh, ride on my amazing sub that looks like the inside of an elevator in a parking lot. It's a $250,000 ride. And all you get to do is go down to see the fucking Titanic. Like, who gives a shit? It wasn't even well built.
Right.
Like, who wants to see the Titanic? Another miasma of missing mission must-haves.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Oh, it's the biggest boat. No, we put these, like, whatever things in it so that the water just tips over from compartment to compartment. There's no, like, what are those called? The walls between the, not ballast.
Bulkheads? But
bulkheads.
Not, yeah, yeah, but like
the bulkheads in the bottom of the Titanic weren't sealed, so like when one of them filled up, it just overflowed into the next bulkhead in the row, and so the whole ship just filled up with water after they punched a hole in it. And like, also, they didn't put anywhere near, like, they knowingly didn't put enough lifeboats on the Titanic because they were like, well, what do you even need these lifeboats for? Nobody's gonna die because it's never gonna sink because we put in tippy bulkheads. So like another thing. And what I found so beautiful and so ironic and so like hilarious about the whole thing was that like all these years later, the Titanic claimed more lives associated with its disaster. Like a century later.
Yeah.
More people are dying in relation to the Titanic crash. So, yeah, they go down and, like, so he's telling everybody, Stockton Rush is telling everybody, like, oh, it's this super amazing ride. And if you want to come on, it's going to cost you $250,000. But here's the thing. Like, the people who were on that sub with him, they didn't pay any fucking money. He was specifically offering, quote unquote, free rides on his sub to people he thought would bring along other people who would pay. So he was basically turning these people into Judas cows.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like putting them in harm's way as a way of like seducing other people who are even more unwitting into paying Stockton Rush for a ride on this thing later down the road. And it was a way of recouping expenses. And so like, he not only put the people who died on his sub with him in harm's way, he was using them as a stepping stone to get to other people he could deceive even more thoroughly into getting onto his submarine and paying him. And I just find that premeditated process of manufacturing like authority or manufacturing competence.
Oh, yeah. No, it's...
like, is so egregious and so fraudulent because this was all about money. So really what this was a giant fraud.
Yeah.
Like, we were talking about the types of lies the other day, right?
Yes.
In the episode that we recorded. This type of a lie, because it involves money and financial gain for one person at the expense of everybody else, is what constitutes a fraud by definition.
Yeah, it's... this is the problem with a lot of the way business is conducted, right? Like, you know, it's just, it's all kind of like, it's none of it's that far away from a Ponzi scheme as it is. Like,
right.
It's sort of like the problem with, I was reading this thing the other day about the problem with MLM versus pyramid schemes, which is that.
Oh, do tell.
So with the reason MLMs get away with being the way they are is that they, at the end of the day, they can kind of defeat like this sort of regulatory requirement that at least the U.S. government has in place, which is that there needs to be sort of an exchange of goods and services for money. Whereas a lot of times pyramid schemes kind of don't have that at the end, right? Like and so like pyramid schemes, typically the way they work is that people are incentivized to recruit people under them so that they can get a cut of the commission, like, and the money sort of flows up. But the thing about pyramid schemes, as I was understanding it, is typically one can expect to recoup if it's functioning the way it is, if I put in a dollar, I can expect to recoup up to 90 cents. So although I'm losing money, I'm not losing my whole dollar. The problem with MLM schemes is that there's a pyramid structure in place, but it's found, it's based on this low-lying exchange of goods. So like you look at like Herbalife or something where there's base at the foundation, there's this unit of can of powdered garbage or whatever that they're selling for,
yeah,
for whatever. And but the problem with MLM schemes is that people can really only expect to recoup at most like 30 cents on a dollar. And so they're actually more insidious because you're going to lose much more of your money when you get sucked into it. And also the article was talking about how like Ponzi schemes are even like are still better than an MLM scheme because mm-hmm. most people who end up in a Ponzi scheme, when it's found out, you still can end up recouping like up to 90 cents from your dollar.
Yeah.
Like once the sort of money, you know, potentially one person at the top can blow some portion right. of it, but usually most of the assets can be recouped and redistributed to the, you know, the marks or the people who got sucked
yes,
into it.
Just like with FTX, yeah. a bunch of like most of the people who lost money on FTX are going to get their money back,
yeah.
which is interesting because I maintain without that type of intervention, nobody ever gets their money back ever from those fucking coin scams.
Right.
Like that's the whole point of the coin scam. So like these people getting money back from FTX because of litigation and because of like the government stepping in and doing something about it legally mm-hmm. are possibly the only people who are going to walk away from yeah. any involvement in cryptocurrency
right.
whatsoever with any money on the back end, because the whole structure of those cryptocurrency things, which we've talked about before, is to siphon your money away from you.
Right.
Like the only people who make any money off of it are the people A, inventing the coin, who B, then run it through an exchange that they own, and C, take fees from the exchange.
Right.
And so like if you're not one of those people, once your money's in there, you're not getting it back in any format.
Right. Yeah, you're.
And so it's kind of interesting to me that the people who lost out to FTX are actually going to be made whole, which is like such a surprise. I did not see that coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Especially after John J. Ray was talking about like how bad their accounting practices were. Like it's incredible to me that they were even able to suss out who is owed what in recompense.
Yeah.
Such a clusterfuck. Oh my God. There's a couple of other like cryptocurrency exchange people who are on the run right now because they've been like, essentially they're wanted
yeah.
because they're full of shit and owe people a bunch of money. Have fun with that.
Have fun with that. Yeah.
What else do we have on our agenda today?
Let's see, what else do we have on our agenda today?
I could tell you that for one of my classes at school, I'm reading a book called Wild by a woman. Yes. And that is also another example of someone writing about their own miasma of missing mission must-haves.
Yes.
But doing it in such a way that they're like, I'm so proud of myself. And I'm like, you are a colossal failure. Uh-huh. Like, you have succeeded by the grace of other people and their willingness to bail you out as strangers throughout your entire memoir
uh-huh.
about what you did. Except you didn't do anything. You just failed in the company of people who were willing to carry you. And she talks about, like, when she first loaded up her pack,
yeah.
like, she set out on the... to hike the Pacific Coast Trail after the rest of her life completely fell apart. And by that, I mean, she imploded it herself.
Uh-huh.
And then her mom dies and she like freaks out. So she's like, I know what the answer is to all my problems. I know nothing about hiking, but I'm going to hike the Pacific Coast Trail, which is basically like walking along the tops of several mountain ranges between Mexico and Oregon.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I've been on a lot of that trail.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've been like zigzagging around it and on either side of it and like up and down it and, like a couple of times
yeah.
for sure. Like just you and me in the car. I know we have
yeah.
On all of our adventures. So like I've been in a lot of the places that she's describing, if not directly on top of the mountain on foot.
Yeah.
But I know what the conditions are like, and I know the general area because I've driven from the south part of it all the way up to almost the north part of it. And so I get the arduousness of this journey, right? And so she like gets to Mojave and brings along this giant ass fucking like hiking backpack. Yes. And in the hotel, like, well, first of all, before she sets out on the thing, she is going through a divorce with her husband, and she gets a tattoo of a blue horse, which is her mother's dead horse, which she shot but didn't kill it right away. So it suffered tremendously as it was dying. And for some reason, she like memorialized that with a tattoo on her arm that she and her husband both got right before they got divorced, like, or right afterwards.
In agreement to, like, we're getting a divorce, let's both get matching horse tattoos.
Matching tattoos. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So that's great. And then she like has this heroin boyfriend. And so she like shoots up like 48 hours before she tries to start hiking this trail, which is just like, way to ensure your own failure. And so she gets to Mojave and she's in this motel and she tries to pack her backpack to take on this trip. Uh-huh. And she can't fit everything she's brought because she has like some giant telescopic lens for her camera. Uh-huh. And like she has like... like one camelback backpack for water. Uh-huh. And that's it. And like all this stuff that was totally unnecessary. Like, she brought a bunch of books with her.
Had she any idea, like, had she talked to anybody about prepping for the, speaking of
willfully avoided, she describes willfully avoiding talking to anybody who's had any experience on the trail whatsoever. And so she gets to this hotel and she like is packing up her pack.
Parallels with the Ocean Gate situation, right? It's like willfully avoiding listening to these experts who've been down there.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, go on.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. No, it's like one for one. So then she like has all of this extraneous crap that she's like, how am I going to carry all this stuff? And she literally like cannot wear the pack and stand upright at the same time. Sorry. Which is like, I don't know how you're going to cross like 2,000 miles on foot in rough terrain if you can't stand up. But and so she like has all of this timing marked out where she's gonna hike X number of miles a day, and then after several days she'll arrive at these sort of like layover spots on the trail where you can like mail yourself stuff in advance so that you can repack your pack with new supplies and food and all this stuff. And she blows her timeline right away. And as she's getting prepared to leave the motel to approach the actual entry point to the trail itself in the Mojave Desert, she realizes that the motel is actually 12 miles away from the entrance to the trail. And she's like, that's really far, and has to hitchhike a ride. Like, she can't even get herself to the start of the trail. And I just, like, I know that, like, the way she wrote this book is supposed to make you, like, read it and be like, this lady's inspiring. And I'm like, this lady's a dangerous moron. Mm-hmm. Just like the fucking Ocean Gate people.
It's sort of, like... Yeah, there's a lot of these ideas, right, where, like, you... this is what kind of was going through my head when you're describing this. Like, I'm thinking of the people who do something for the first time, right? Like, so the first person to go down to the Mariana Trench, or like, they didn't know, right? Like, they didn't know what was down there, what to expect. They did a lot of the groundwork, and one could argue that they were still unprepared. But I think there's this difference where, generally, these people, like, they make these decisions based on, like, okay, well, I don't know what that is, but let's like ease into it, let's go like halfway, or let's do and then I think there's this problem with people who see that somebody has done something already, but they want to have the first time experience by not talking and finding out what it's like, or what might you know, what one might need to do to prepare for it. And so then but then they just reach the whole way rather than like easing into it and learning the less, like, the hard lessons in a safer way, right? It's just like, oh, I've never really hiked at all backpacking, I'm just gonna do the entire Pacific Crest Trail. Which is, you know, like, anyway.
There's like ignorance. Yeah. You know, like, people who are actually doing something about which you can't know all of the details.
Right.
And then there's like a rejection of all of the things you could know that other people have taken the risk to develop the knowledge base.
Right.
And you just are like, not interested.
Yeah.
Like, fuck you, lady.
Right.
And so then she has to get like all of this help from people along the way who are basically like, you're going to die out here if I don't give you like this food or water or shoes or whatever. Right.
And so this like and person like, who's like meticulously packed and prepared is now giving up some like one of their backup things.
Yeah,
and now they're at
yeah,
risk because
exactly.
you decided to risk everything.
Right. And we have also, you and I have been in situations with people like this where it's like, you didn't prepare when you knew you should have.
Yes.
And now the rest of us are faced with a moral obligation not to let you fail.
Right. Right.
So now I have to either go out of my way to help you or I'm the asshole. Mm-hmm. Because you didn't fucking prepare and... in this process, you're bringing everybody down with you.
I think what's frustrating about those situations is like the gray area, right? So like there's the area yeah. of like, it's clear you made attempts to educate and understand, and this is your first time, and we don't want to like, you know, I'm pleased to be here and help you as someone who has more experience versus
yeah.
like you willfully and ignorant, like, you know, you willfully engaged with your ignorance to come out here and suffer and inflict your suffering on other people,
mm-hmm.
which is where it starts to,
yeah.
because there's definitely like, there's this aspect of like, if we're going to engage in a sort of like risky behavior, like we're going to go, you know, adventure in the woods or whatever. There's this certain inherent,
yeah.
like, yeah, it's hard. Like even with all of our fail safes and our well, you know, meaning judgments and, you know, lots of preparation, things still go wrong. And,
right.
and the idea that one might share and work with somebody else is not a problem. The problem comes from that sort of like engaged willful ignorance and then just like the expectation mm-hmm. of strangers to just swoop in and be like, hey, it's great. It's
yeah.
like why I don't really have an issue with like people who go off into the woods and then end up like getting life flighted out necessarily. The problem is like, it's like, oh, now it's happening like 50 times a month because somebody wants to do an Instagram photo and they showed up in their like their Gucci shorts or whatever
yes.
and their high heels and fell off the side of a mountain, as opposed to
right.
like someone who's like, I'm going to do this thing and here's all my backups and none of, and all of those failed and now I'm doing the last ditch effort of calling the search and rescue or whatever. Like that, this is not, you know, I want all of those things so we can be, you know, engage in these endeavors,
mm-hmm.
but also like, you know, all the first shit as well, like all the safety and all of the like the preparation should be there.
Yeah.
And the fact that
yeah,
you can
so
just,
like
you know, bypass that just is, you know, like why the Ocean
annoying.
Gate thing is so fucking annoying to me. Like if that had been someone else who'd been like doing this for a long time or, you know, had this reputation of like attempting to do these like endeavors with safety and like a support team and all of this other shit.
Right.
And then, you know, and then, yeah, like, of course, like, you know, one of the reasons we try to like have maritime laws to kind of ensure the safety of people and encourage people to continue to be able to like explore boundaries. But
right.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know.
Yeah, it's about mitigating risk.
Mitigating risk, right, exactly. And that's when you look at yeah. something like Ocean Gate or this wild, like where you're just like, no, like not only did you not mitigate risk, but like there's strong evidence that you actively tried to thwart any attempt to mitigate it.
Yes. Yes, that's the whole thing.
Right.
It's like you're deliberately doing things to ensure your own failure.
Yeah.
And then when that happens, predictably, you're going to rely on the other people putting themselves in harm's way to bail you out.
Right.
That is your plan.
Yeah. Like,
I have a problem with that plan.
Exactly. Yes.
If that's your plan going in, I have some problems.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the ignorance versus the rejection of like knowledge that it really bothers me. Like, and so I like this in this book, which is called Wild by a woman named Cheryl Strayed. And her last name, Strayed, is a name that she gave herself when she got the divorce. It's not her actual name. And it's Strayed, S-T-R-A-Y-E-D, as in like Cheryl Strayed from the straight and narrow path
uh-huh.
or whatever. And that just made me hate her also. And like, so I got through the first 7 chapters of this book that I'm reading for this memoir class that I'm taking. And then in like chapters 7 and 8, I was like, okay, maybe she was just like painting herself retrospectively in the first half of
yeah.
the book as like a really obnoxious person so that when she turns the corner and becomes like a more, I don't know how to describe what I am thinking. When she becomes less of a dipshit,
mm-hmm.
it's like clearer in the text of people. Like I was like, maybe she's writing it this way to make the contrast more contrasted. Like, right. Oh, look how terrible she was and look how great she is now because she had all of this enlightenment while she was walking along the trail. No, no. It lasted for like two chapters. And then she was like telling in her more enlightened voice about things that happened before she became more enlightened. But the way that she talks about the things that happened before she became more enlightened in her currently more enlightened voice doesn't make me any more confident right. that she's actually any more enlightened. Right. Like, she tells the story about having to shoot. Well, she didn't have to shoot her mom's horse. That's the thing. They could have just gotten a vet to come out and euthanize the horse. Uh-huh. But they all decided they weren't going to do that. Her brother and like some other person. And so they just like shot this fucking horse. But because they shot it, I think, with like a 223 or something, like it didn't kill the horse. Yeah. So then they had to shoot it like five more times, but none of those bullets killed the horse either because they weren't big enough. So the horse just like suffered tremendously as it was dying slowly from being shot six fucking times.
Yeah.
And then she's like, oh, but thank God I got that blue horse tattoo and now I know I'm forgiven. And I'm like, I hate you again. I hated you to begin with. Then I didn't hate you as much. And now I hate you even more. Mm-hmm. Because you're putting me on a hate roller coaster. Oh, gosh. So I'm at some point I need to finish this book because I do need to read it for class. And I have something like how many pages left here? I'm on page 230 and I need to get to page 300 essentially. So I've got like basically roughly a third of the book left. And I don't think I'm going to like her anymore by the time I'm done.
That's fair. Yeah. It's, I mean, we've read other books like that. Like immediately what comes to mind is Sapiens.
Sapiens.
I think you made it a little further than I did.
I did, only because I was propelled by rage.
That's right. Yeah. You were like, I'm going to, yeah. Yeah.
I was propelled forward in my, reading of Sapiens through the introduction, which is where you got mired in. Mm-hmm. And I made it through chapter one, which is where I ran out of Post-it flags, yes. flagging all of the shit uh-huh. that was wrong with that book from an academic perspective.
Yeah.
And I was like, I can't even after this. And the reason I was so compelled to read that piece of shit in the first place was because people who taught me in college mm-hmm. recommended it to me, and then I read parts of it, and my whole opinion about the intelligence of those people who made the recommendations shifted, and the floor fell out from under me, mm-hmm. and I thought, oh my God, the fact that you can't discern that this is all bullshit
right.
is very concerning to me.
Yeah.
Like, you should know better. Also, why can't you tell that this is all fake?
Also, refer back to our previous episode, that where we talked about like bullshit, right? Where it's not
yeah.
like as a lie, it's not whether it's true or false. It's just a blatant disregard for whether it's true or false.
Yes. And that doesn't matter whether it's true or false. Just going to say
fantastic
that.
Summation of Sapiens. It's like, you know, there's yeah. some true shit in there probably, I guess. I don't know. It doesn't matter. There's a complete disregard for yeah. it. It's just like, I have a fantasy about the past, like human history, and here it is. Mm-hmm. And now I'm going to represent yep. it as if it's true. And, you know, I hope you also get off on this shit, like the idea that you might have sex with like a different species.
Right.
That was which like, just that comes thing just jumped out of here.
So
like,
jarring.
Yeah. It was like, where is this? Like, and like, it was not treated in a, it wasn't even like, you know, here's a rare sort of biological event where they're, you know, yeah. are they different species? Because, you know, the definition of a species being that they can, you know, produce viable offspring together, right?
Right.
And then, but he talks about it as like, how titillating is that, that you could be sleeping with someone who's not of your species? Like, what?
Ooh.
Just so, so fucking yeah. weird.
Okay. Well, and recently in, there's a newsletter that I read that's yeah. Published, I think, like, well, it's every day. What am I talking about? Yeah. It's called The Daily Reformer. My God. And so they publish every day. They publish at least one, if not several articles about current goings on at the Minnesota State Legislature, things that are in session and being discussed and debated and like bills and laws and all of these things. And the person who is one of the major contributors to this newsletter the other day mentioned that he like was reading Sapiens and listed several things about it that he really liked. And so I sent him an email directly, which I generally don't do because I'm like, newsletters are like to inform people. They're not to like spark debate. And so I generally just read stuff and then archive it for reading later, which I'll never get back to ever. And I'm just like a digital hoarder. This one I felt compelled to respond to because in the same way, I'm like, I don't want this person who's writing this like newsletter that reaches lots and lots of people to like labor under the impression that Yuval Noah Harari has like any grounds whatsoever to speak about the things that he speaks about in his books that are not published through the university where he earned his PhD, which is like the hallmark of someone who's disreputable.
Right.
So like, I was just like, why doesn't your university publish your shit? Oh, because you're writing outside of your fucking discipline and you actually don't have any grounds to like write about any of this stuff. So he like, the guy who writes this newsletter, I wrote him an email and I was like, hey, I noticed that you were talking about Sapiens and I just have to tell you that that book is awful. Like,
yeah.
It is not supported. None of what he talks about is accepted. Like, if you're interested in the types of things that he talks about, but you actually want to hear from somebody who knows what they're talking about and cites their sources and gives you the background for why they think what they think, like, you should read The Dawn of Everything by David Wengrow. And they specifically in their text address the issues in books that Jared Diamond wrote, like Guns, Germs, and Steel, which is full of all kinds of bullshit that's demonstrably flawless. Stuff that Steven Pinker writes, The Angels of Our Better Nature is a book that he wrote that's all just garbage. And Yuval Noah Harari with his book Sapiens, and then the follow-up to that, which is like Homo Deus, I think is the name of his other book. But anyway, don't read that one either because it's just more garbage.
Right.
And so I wanted to like give the person who writes this newsletter an opportunity to be like, oh, this is terrible. And when you compare these two books side by side, Sapiens and Dawn of Everything, you can see one of them is a serious book and the other one is some guy like fantasizing about fucking horses.
Right. Yeah, it's just so funny.
You know what I mean? Yes. And so I thought, like, you are another person whose work up to this point I have respected as authoritative and insightful. Mm-hmm. And so I just want you to know that as someone who appreciates that, here is a resource for you if you liked Sapiens that actually talks about real shit.
Right.
And has real citation and is worthy of your time and effort to read. And he responded to me and said, oh, thank you. I actually have The Dawn of Everything. And I was like, motherfucker, that means you can't tell the difference either.
Right? Like, what is happening?
Like, that means that your lack of discernment is what accounts for the fact that you can't tell horseshit from actual academic work.
Right.
Like, the fact that you can't tell the difference is so concerning to me.
It's pretty unsettling. Yeah.
God damn it. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of disappointed. He's like, maybe I'll write a column about Dawn of Everything. I was like, yes, do that, please.
Yeah, please do.
God. And stop talking about Sapiens. Like, it's interesting to me. So there are these moments, these cultural moments mm-hmm. in America, which is the only culture that I'm really exposed to on any regular basis, right?
Right.
And then you can get as granular as you want about that. The culture of Minnesota within America, within the 20th and 21st century, whatever, right? But like, the thing that kind of drives me nuts is that like, there are these touch points culturally where people who have no interest in a thing generally become obsessed with the thing. Like, people who don't give a fuck about archaeology or like early agriculture or like the migratory habits of humans mm-hmm. 10, 15,000 years ago, whatever. Like, nobody gives a shit about that until Yuval Noah Harari writes a fake book about it. And now everybody's suddenly an expert on early human life.
Right.
You know, or like, or something happens like politically and now everybody's a fucking constitutional scholar all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, you're not. Mm-hmm. No, you're not. You can't react to some event in human existence and then suddenly become interested in it and speak on it like you knew about it the whole time. Why does this happen here? Yeah. Like, like a history professor who barely got his PhD in history starts writing about anthropology, and everybody who doesn't know what anthropology is like, this guy's a genius. Yes. What do you think about AI?
And then, of course, the problem is that the anthropology field doesn't have a lot of, like, generally, like, very public clout, because mostly people aren't fucking right. looking at it. And now all right. the fucking actual anthropologists are like, that guy's full of shit, and no one's listening because there's not enough of them to make it, like, seem of import.
Right.
And so then you've got people like Bill Gates being like, this is the most profound book I've ever read.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. People who have no business commentating on whether or not it has merit are like, this is amazing. Like my old fucking
professor. It's not even, like, the worst part is it's, like, not even that well written.
No, it's terrible. It's like, a fucking mess. It makes me so angry how much people like that book.
Yeah. It's almost just like,
it's so bad.
It's almost just like it just like lucked into touching on like some deep-seated fantasy that no one realized a lot of people had.
Well, his whole Yuval Noah Harari's whole gist with the book Sapiens is like, you're right, everything is fucked, and here's why.
Yeah.
And he goes back and blames it on the fact that like he blames it on mass agriculture. He's like, the whole reason that shit's fucked now
right.
is because everybody started farming instead of being bands of 150 people hunting and gathering. And the Davids are like, okay, the whole like bands of people hunting and gathering yeah. in numbers no more than 150 is a lie that never happened.
Right.
That's not like a component of the human past.
Yeah.
And then they go about like showing over eons of time the mountain of evidence of how people actually lived, and agriculture's been going on for fucking ever, like a really long time. It's not like shit was fine until we all started having too many people because of agriculture, and now shit's fucked, which is basically the like super reductive argument that Yuval Noah Harari makes,
and then doesn't bother to tell. Like,
never explicitly said, and he doesn't do anything to cite any reasons why he thinks this. He just like makes shit up. It's like, no citation, no, zero citation whatsoever. So he basically steals a bunch of ideas, misstates them after other people had them, and then uses those misstatements to like pad his own assumptions about how life used to be and how life will be because of these things that he's made up. And people are like, this guy's like a philosopher, which is what he's calling himself now, by the way.
Well, yeah, you have to, because you can't take, you know, you can't be some kind of like factual, you just have to dispute, you know, not to disparage philosophy. It's just sort of like there's no, the burden of proof is like completely shifted away from like reality, right? You're kind of
I mean, like, well, the fact of the matter is, like, I don't know why he's calling himself a philosopher, because he doesn't actually do any of the things that people who work in the discipline of philosophy do. So he's not a philosopher.
I think
thinking about shit is not philosophy.
I think what I mean to say actually is that I can see why he would call himself a philosopher, is because the idea is that he saw, like, he's trying to cater to the popular opinion of his books, right? And say,
yes.
like, oh, people have formed philosophy around this, and so now I'm going to say I'm a philosopher. Like, I'm going to key in on that and be like, yes, I am your savior who wrote this, like, important text.
Yeah, like, he keeps inserting himself, like, he offers himself up as a speaker and goes on, like, morning talk shows and this and that and the other thing. And then when people ask him questions that are completely outside of his scope of expertise, he doesn't say, oh, you know what, that's not actually what I know anything about, so I can't answer that question. You should read XYZ discipline to learn about that. He just goes off and talks about whatever anybody asks him as if he's an authority on everything because he wrote a book that's fake. Like, what? I hate him so much.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I hate him so much. I wouldn't even hate him so much if he didn't have so much sway over how average people thought.
That's the right. This is what's just so frustrating. I mean,
like, if he just wrote a dead end book that's full of nonsense, like so many people do, I'd be like, whatever, and ignore it. But the fact that people are giving him credit for having good ideas, which he does not have.
Right. Right, right. No.
Not only are his ideas not good, they're thoroughly unsupported. People are like, this guy's some kind of a genius because he says things I like to hear.
Right.
His book also, Sapiens, is like super racist. Like, it doesn't come out like blunt in the text that he's being racist, but the whole thing is basically like these people couldn't have been smart enough to do any of this stuff. And it wasn't until this other stuff happened with these other smarter people who are all white that like any of this started to make sense. Like it's deeply, deeply biased against anyone who isn't.
It's just like, I mean, I think I feel dumb. Like I was getting flavors of that when it was like, I was like, oh, he's talking about fucking like other species.
Yeah.
And how exciting that might be. And I'm like, oh, this is like,
right.
Usually people who think that way also like to think about other people as other so that they can have this like,
yes, weird less vibe, than human. Less than human.
Yeah. Where it's like, oh,
yeah.
I mean, imagine how great it'd be to have sex slaves. How amazing would that be? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's got these weird vibes like that where it's just like, dude, you're gross.
Wouldn't Stop subjugating it. Other people and animals be amazing, you guys? Yeah, so he's just like, it's super gross.
Yeah.
So like the weird like racial biases in his book like are there, but they're just under the surface. And I don't think like if you're reading his book without a critical eye, you're probably not even going to notice. Like if you read anything he says in the introduction, and you're like, this guy's making some good points. You're gonna blow right past all the stuff that's biased and objectionable.
Yeah.
You're just not going to see it. So that, like, another thing. But that book is a miasma of missing mission must-haves. Like, if you're going to write an academic text about the fucking past, which there's mountains of evidence about how that went.
Yeah.
Like, and you're going to disregard all of the, like, studies and the work people have put into it and where all of that information comes from, and you're not going to cite any of your sources, and you're just going to rip off and half change other people's ideas and then pass them off as your own and basically like plagiarize information, except I'm not even sure it's plagiarism because you're not even like making it the whole way to the truth. Like like gross. You're missing everything that you need to be a reputable author at that point. Like you're just bullshitting.
The critical reception segment on Yuval Noah Harari in Wikipedia as of February 29th, 2024.
God.
So I love these.
Somebody updated it today?
No, I'm just saying that's when I'm reading it.
Oh.
Yeah, for to cite my references.
Yes.
You know, I mean, nobody needs to do that. That's unimportant. But so there's a quote Ian Parker wrote in 2020 in The New Yorker that Harari did not invent big history. This is sort of the category that a lot of his writings fall into.
Had the big picture of everything. Why is everything the way it is starting from the beginning till now?
Yeah. So
Ian
Parker writes in The New Yorker, and I have to feel like this is such a great backhanded compliment. He says, Harari did not invent big history, but updated it with hints of self-help and futurology, as well as high altitude, almost nihilistic composure about human suffering.
Yes. Oh, that's so well said.
It's like, it's just full of like, it's full of like, dude, you didn't actually, like what you did was just paint some bullshit on top of this, but I'm going to say it in a way that is palatable so that people can think I'm paying you a compliment.
Right.
And then, the next sentence in the next paragraph is, his work has been more negatively received in academic circles.
If you're someone who doesn't know anything about anything, you might like Yuval Noah Harari.
Yeah. So, an anthropologist named Christopher Robert Hallpike, we don't need to go too much into his accolades, but is an anthropologist, stated in a 2020 review of Sapiens that one has often had to point out how surprisingly little he seems to have read in quite a number of essential topics. It would be fair to say that whenever his facts are broadly correct, they are not new. And whenever he tries to strike out on his own, he often gets things wrong, sometimes seriously.
Oh my God. Perfect explanation of his like MO. Like, oh, the things you could look up, you get wrong. And then like the other stuff, you just kind of like invent poorly.
Right. Christopher Hallpike further states that we should not judge Sapiens as a serious contribution to knowledge, but as infotainment, a publishing event to titillate its readers by a wild intellectual ride across the landscape of history, dotted with sensational displays of speculation and ending with blood-curdling predictions about human destiny. By these criteria, it is a most successful book.
Right.
Which Yeah, and I love that sort of... The funny thing is, I tried to skip around and find out what these fucking blood-curdling predictions about human destiny was, which is think hooks a lot of people. I think that's...
Yes, because people are like, oh my God, this guy's been right about everything up till now, and he's saying forward-looking, it's all coming crashing down. What do we do? Yeah. And then they ask him, and then he's like, well, I'll tell you what you can do.
Right, I'm a philosopher.
Fuck a horse. I'm a philosopher who fucks horses. Right.
Some people really like horses.
Some people love horses. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, should we try and wrap up? Our
sure.
intrepid research team has provided us with colors of the day.
Great job, team. Ooh, these are really good. These are so Eastery.
Yep.
Oh, man. The church that I went to as a kid, let me rephrase that. The church that I was forced to attend as a child.
Yes.
In a popularized form of child abuse known as religious education. The church that I was forced to go to was like an old ass Catholic church in St. Paul, not the big famous cathedral,
right,
but a smaller one, and in the same diocese that like went bankrupt from defending itself against all the sexual violence claims against the priests, which never happened to me, thank God. Nobody ever did anything particularly untoward to me other than trying to force me to think a certain way, which is bad enough.
Sure.
But that church burnt down. And when they rebuilt the church on the same piece of land, they rebuilt it as this like ultra modern brutalist structure that is like so devoid of any of the detail that makes a creepy ass church even remotely welcoming to the attendees and participants of the church services. This church was like a big brick box and it had no windows. I mean, it's like a death trap in there.
Yeah.
Super high ceilings. And the only decor they ever included in this like stark ass fucking geometric hard angled box were these really tall, skinny drapes that they hung behind the altar at the front of the church that at Easter time were in pastel colors. And it's one of my only like not terrifying memories of being in that space, because I also had to be like an altar kid, which means I had to like bring the priest like the host and like the wine during the mass and stuff, which required me to like memorize when you were supposed to do all of these arbitrary things that don't make any sense because they don't actually mean anything. And so like I hated it because I don't like being the center of attention in front of large groups of people, generally speaking. Sure. In some contexts, it's okay. But like for the most part, I would rather just do things behind the scenes and make sure everything gets off without a hitch. Like I'm a logistician, not like a performer.
Right.
So I hated doing on many, 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 many levels. I hated being like an altar.
Yeah.
Whatever. They used to be called altar boys, but then they were like, equal opportunity to fuck people up. Girls can do it now, too.
Right.
So, like, I hated doing that. And I remember sitting in church staring at those pastel, like, drapery thingies because they were the only, like, not ugly thing to look at.
Right. Right.
And these colors are giving me flashbacks. It's even the right time of year. It's almost April. They're giving me flashbacks because they would have them in pink and kind of a yellow and like a pale green and a pale blue. And today's colors are like half of the decor that they would include in the church in springtime. They're very springy. I love these colors,
right, so
even though I'm now associating
colors?
Them.
So we've got two colors. We've got arbitrary outcry and hospitable ruffle. So unarbitrary outcry. Go ahead.
RGB 235, 239, 174. So lots of red, lots of green, and a little less blue. It's like on a Crayola color crayon, this is the color spring green. It's like a very yellow green.
Yes.
And it's very pastel, very light.
Right, right.
And then
go ahead.
Hospitable ruffle is... the hexadecimal.
Yeah.
The hexadecimal for unarbitrary outcry, the spring green color.
And you can chuck this in the Googler. If you type this into Google, you'll see the color specifically that we're talking about.
Yeah, it will come up on your monitor. Yep. It's hashtag EB E-F-A-E. So what are the call numbers for the alphabet? Echo, yeah, Echo, Bravo, Echo, Foxtrot, Alpha, Echo.
Good job. Yeah. So that's an arbitrary outcry. It's mm-hmm. just really like very light yellow, green, pastel.
Yes. Yeah. It's very nice.
And then, so Hospitable Ruffle, RGB for that is 125.204.223. And the hexadecimal value, again, is #7DeltaCharlieCharlieDeltaFoxtrot. That's #7DCCDF. Type that in Google. This is like, I describe this as like sort of like a cooler robin egg blue, mm-hmm. or like a little bit darker. Like it's got this sort of grayish vibe to it, just a little bit. Oh, it really yeah. makes it a more pastel, right? Like it's not vibrantly bright.
Yeah,
the way the unarbitrary outcry is, it's a little more muted, I guess. Like with them together, mm-hmm. this is what I see, and of course, this is why we put them together and why we have yeah. two colors of the day and not one.
Right. So, right.
Yeah.
Frame of reference. You gotta have something to contrast, otherwise it all just washes out into the same thing. Yeah. So yeah, these are great. I mean, I think the titles are excellent.
Yep.
An arbitrary outcry, like that's me complaining about church right there.
100%.
I mean,
yep.
Hospitable Ruffle. That's
those are the pastel draperies that you could look at. The one,
yeah,
yep. Amazing.
pretend you're not in a church.
Right.
Yeah. Oh my God, they're so good. Those very. Very good colors.
Well, you mentioned that the church was sort of this brutalist architecture.
Yeah, it's terrible.
And
oh my God, it looks like a jail from the outside.
So we should maybe do an episode on that because I think brutalism is fascinating.
I
say fascinating because it's not inherently, like in many ways it eschews by design any sense of beauty or organicness. So basically it's sort of a philosophical approach to architectural design, striving to create simple, honest, and functional buildings that accommodate their purpose, inhabitants, and location. And so it's funny because like that, I agree with that philosophy. Like I think that's a great design philosophy,
yeah.
right?
Right.
but it is interesting how you also
end how it up, gets interpreted.
Yeah, like you get these very boxy cement, like bare cement concrete structures with it's very like sort of 90s sci-fi dystopian movie vibes.
Yeah.
They're also like I think it's, you know, I can imagine that there are forms of brutalism like architecture that I might actually really like. Like there's a place called Habitat 67 in Montreal, Quebec, Canada, that is considered a brutalist building. And it's actually really interesting to look at. I can't say whether it would be a nice place to live or not. It's also, I think also it's like very subjective, like what appeals to you, like what actually like makes you feel better when you're like living in a space like that. It's definitely this particular one I'm talking about is I'll drop you a picture so you can look and then we'll try to describe it to the
the
listeners. But I would like to do a whole episode on not just this building.
Yes.
But this it looks like it's kind of like what you might build with Legos when you were just kind of like freeform stacking bricks and building this sort of weird sort of. Like
or like shoeboxes.
Yeah, like a bunch of shoeboxes sort of stacked together weirdly. Because the thing is, they're not uniformly stacked. Like they're kind of haphazardly.
Right.
Like there's spaces between some of them. It's not.
They're like at right angles. The layers are at right angles to each other. So like the second floor is not the same footprint as the first floor. Mm-hmm. Like it's like there's the first floor of a building, and then the next floor up, the building is rotated like 90 degrees so that they're stacked like alternating.
And what really appeals. So this is. We're looking at a photo of Habitat 67 Southwest View from Wikipedia.org on the Brutalist Architecture page. And this is like, it's to me, I think what appeals to me about this is that it creates all of these unique and interesting like edges and interfaces where it's sort of regular in its irregularity. And You can imagine like every one of those living spaces might have similar provisions in terms of like overall space, but each one of them has different layouts and where your windows are, look out into different spaces. I think it's this is probably a better example of like a more appealing kind of brutalism. It's also well covered in green space around it, and there's sort of, at least from this view, it gives indication that there's like room for people to have gardens, and it looks very pleasing to me. But
yeah,
you know, for sure I would choose this over, say, like a Charlie Munger structure, like a jail or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
I forwarded an image that's taken of St. Matthew's Church to you. That's like just from the kitty corner, the street corner.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so there's like a church spire, like you would expect to see on any church, but it's just a giant rectangle like a chimney.
Yes. Yeah.
And like the whole building is just like super, like there's no windows except very tiny near the top.
Oh, yeah.
So like when you're in it, you're just in this giant black box.
It looks like a utility building, like where they're like, well, there's nobody who actually goes in here, so we don't need to spend any money on windows, but we need to make it look at least presentable on the outside, so we'll give it a nice brick facade.
Yes.
And that's it.
Yes.
Like it's just,
yes,
you know, it's like, it, why looks is like that a jail, even that tower there? Like there's this weird, like it almost looks like an old fire station tower. Some fire stations had these towers where they would hang the hoses after they were used so that they could drain out and dry, and to me that's what this looks like.
Yes, it's very utilitarian. It's not like,
yeah,
it's not, what am I trying to say? Decorative.
No,
like,
it's not. Yeah.
It's, there's nothing beautiful about it. Yeah. So I always just thought that was really weird, because as a kid, I was like, this does not look like a church.
Right.
Like, I know church happens here,
yes,
but it doesn't, yeah, it looks like a building that was repurposed after the fact into a church because a church wasn't available or something. I actually wonder if the same people who designed that church designed the high school that I went to, which is Henry Sibley High School in Mendota Heights, because the physical structure around the placement and the style of windows is like a dead ringer for our high school, which only had windows on one side of the building.
Right.
So again, you were just in this giant square right angled black box when you were in that building. There was no visibility into the outside world.
Yeah.
It's nuts. And I should like look that up and see if it was the same architects or whatever, or the same builders.
Well, let's save that for another episode.
Yeah,
definitely.
That's a great idea. Yeah. I would love to do the brutalist topic.
Okay. All right.
Well, I wrote it down.
Thank you everybody for listening. send us an email, Dana, DANA at FCBM.io, or go to the website, yes, FCBM.io, and you can get other email addresses. But we'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening. Okay, bye.
Okay, bye.